My name is Maria Pereira. I live in Portugal. My background is in banking and finance. And today I'll be talking about Money, Love, and Virtue, which is a book that I'm currently writing. Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to be here. And I would like to thank the Glasgow Centre for Population Health for the invitation and the International Futures Forum for inviting me also. To Andrew, my friend, and to Graham, who's here, and Alison, who's been doing a lot of work in organizing this, and also to Carol. I don't see where Carol is, but anyway, Carol, there she is. She's been helping with the organization. So, yes, money, love, and virtue. Just today we had a discussion this morning, and someone said, God, these words are so dissonant together. And I said, yes, they are. And perhaps it's time to find the resonance in them again. And my background is in finance. I've worked in the financial field. I got a master's in business administration years ago in finance. But I've always been interested in philosophy. So this reflection brings in a lot of philosophical ideas, as you shall see. So the reflection started, I think, about 10 years ago, although really probably has been with me all my life. As they say, any story starts from one's youth. But when the financial crisis occurred, and it further showed that the ethical breakdown that started with Enron and with WorldCom was much more established within the system, and it wasn't just isolated cases, but had become systemic. So initially, the blame was on government for undertaking wrong policy, for believing in unfettered markets, for deregulation, and for deficit in the supervision of banks. Because even though there was deregulation, there was still certain regulation in place. But the regulation that was in place was not paid heed to. And of course, the banks got the brunt of the criticism, as they very well should have, for inadequate quality control of credit, for forgetting the purpose of banking, which is to serve society, and for forgetting the whole genesis of banking, which is trust and confidence, because credit comes from the word credo, which comes from the fides, which comes from faith. So faith and confidence and trust is an integral part of the banking system, of the financial system, and that was forgotten. So as the story started coming out, it also became evident that there was a lot of unethical behavior behind it. Not just unethical behavior, but fraud, LIBOR fixing, mis-selling of securities, designing products really to make the clients lose money so that banks can make money, as in the case of, you know, many examples. And at the beginning, it seemed like government was very happy to let banks go along and that the public was paying the price. But in fact, in recent times, we have seen a whole series of prosecution and major fines paid by the banking sector. So it seems as government is really starting to try to put the house in order. But when I started thinking about it, and the call for regulation and increased capital requirements and all of that, I felt uncomfortable because there's something much, much, much deeper that we're not touching. And so I started to think about, well, what is the financial ideology behind the crisis? And Adam Smith, Glasgow's famous son, is always used to justify aggressive competition through the principle of self-interest. And it's also used to justify free markets, because free markets were supposed to result in benefit for all through the invisible hand. And the government's role is really to keep the economic wheel turning. So financialization was seen since the 1980s as the way to really keep the economic wheel turning, because the industrial sector was starting to decline. And so for a while, it was really a virtuous cycle. In the 80s was a very prosperous time, and the economies kept on growing. But the problem is that they didn't know when to stop. So the debt bubble just got bigger and bigger. And we finally came to the collapse in 2008. But if we look at Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, we can see why the market adapted the position they do. Because if you just read the words without going beyond what behind what the words say, and further into his book and his thinking, you say, yes, it's true, because in the description of self-interest, it says it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interests. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages. The merchant intends only his own gain, and he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. So Adam Smith apparently believed in the Stoic providence. So for him, the invisible hand was really a hand of providence to create the desirable results for society based on all the different action. Now, but what people who use the term self-interest to justify aggressive competition do not mention that for Adam Smith, self-command was very important. Sympathy was important. He was, after all, more a philosopher. But the word self-command got lost in the whole process. And when Adam Smith brought about his synthesis, it was really, we have to look back in history, because I felt in order to understand the present, to try to envisage the future, I have to understand history. I have to understand why we are where we are and what brought us to this. And Adam Smith's book was written in 1776, which was the year of the Declaration of Independence. It was 8 years, was it 8 years? Yes, no. 1789, so 13 years before the French Revolution. So it was, they were really heady days of the Enlightenment, where there was great promise, optimism. You know, with science and with reason, the human being was finally able to control his or her own destiny and no longer reliant on some invisible, not an invisible hand, but an invisible providence to decide one's fate. So, and it was a period when the market system was beginning. So commercial life was beginning and aristocracy was declining. Mercantilism was on its way out. So the privileged classes were on their way. They were making space for the public, for the merchants. So it was a wonderful synthesis to really explain what the new economic system was going to be like. And wealth was seen as a precondition to liberty, as allowing for equality, and as enabling, as being enabled by fraternity. So, yes, wealth is important. We focus on liberty today. It's used as a justification for the capitalist system. We pay lip service to equality, but we have forgotten fraternity. We don't talk about it anymore. Starting to now, fortunately. But in the height of the financial boom, there was no talk about it. It was really about brutal competition and may the best person win. And so I got very interested then in the Enlightenment principles, which my friends at IFF are also quite interested in, you know, all the discussion around the Second Enlightenment. And I started thinking, this is interesting. So we use liberty to adjust, argue on behalf of free markets, but what's the thinking behind it? And then I started reading many of the, you know, classics, and I came upon, you know, John Locke, whom I always knew as the one who came up with the treatise explaining the concept of property, but I never read him. And then I thought, oh, this is very interesting, because in fact, Locke had ideas behind him, which is very close to the ideas of money, love, and virtue. Because Locke, he saw property as a way to freedom and protection, because he saw that it was a fundamental nature, I mean, a fundamental law of human nature, self-preservation. And he saw a continuity in the political system through the ownership of property, passing property on from generation to generation. But that implies actually responsibility for the future generation. It's not debt that's being passed on. It's property that's being passed on. It's wealth that's being passed on. And he saw freedom not simply as an absence of restraint, but also as something positive, as a creation of civil society, as allowing for government and laws. And he saw that what was required was the virtue of other regarding, fraternity, looking at the other person, being concerned about the other person. And civil society as a living body of separate individuals. There's a concept of unity behind it, which is really the concept of love. So I thought, oh, but that's not what people normally talk about when they talk about property or they talk about Locke or they talk about Smith. It's just about self-interest and advancement and wealth creation. So I went further, and John Stuart Mill, who is actually one of my favorite economists, he was, in a way, the one to start this path towards abstraction, but he was a man of really contradictions, as we shall see, you know, later on. But he wrote a book called The Principles of Political Economy in 1848, which served as really the book, the reference book for economics for the most of the latter part of the 19th century. And in it, he described the human being as being a rational wealth maximizer. So the motivation of human action is wealth maximization. The human being is a standard economic agent. And there's abstraction of every other human motives. Okay? And he said the simplification is necessary because this is the mode in which science must necessarily proceed. So it all comes down to this issue of science, the use of science. And science has to be something very rigorous, very mathematical, and it cannot be qualitative. But nonetheless, Mill actually stepped, he was sort of in between Adam Smith's qualitative approach to economy and what came afterwards, which is the full abstraction. Because they still believed in happiness, the search for happiness. They still believed that, yes, man wants to maximize wealth, but wealth is a way to happiness. And Mill, as you know, was a disciple of Jeremy Bentham, who developed the theory of utilitarianism. But because of science, it was necessary to have a mathematical measure of happiness. So he devised his philosophic calculus. Now, his approach of happiness is a hedonistic one. It's a maximization of pleasure and a minimization of pain, which actually informed Victorian society, including in the penal system. Now, with this desire to turn economics into pure science, by the end of the 19th century, there were new economists that came into the scene where they really went about to purge economics of all philosophy and determined that all philosophy, anything that's qualitative cannot be included. It has to be quantitative. Anything that cannot be measured cannot be trusted because it contains a seed of a bias. Well, we know now that actually mathematics and also mathematics per se cannot include the bias, but the premise behind the mathematical principles that you're working with or the assumptions you're working with, that definitely can contain bias. So we had a series of economists, starting with Menger, Jevons, and who developed the theory of utility, which is really the fundamental law of human nature assumed in economics, that humans seek to maximize economic utility. So we have brought it one step even further into abstraction because it's not just maximizing wealth, but it's maximizing wealth utility. And subsequently, we had Wicksteed and Pareto who came up with the theory of instrumentality, whereby they said, we don't need to know what the purpose or the motivation behind choice is. We only need to know the economic preference. And that is a given. We have to have no regard for motivation. Once we know what the preference is, then we can, through the economic principles, determine what the most efficient way is to arrive at providing society with the preferences. So because resources are scarce, we have to seek to minimize input and maximize output. So that's when the term efficiency came into being. And even today, it is really what we work around. Whatever we do, efficiency is the main guiding post. So two boxes were developed, systematic laws ought to permit quantitative analysis. And By the time that the London School of Economics was founded in 1895, well, then economics as a science had arrived. Now, someone hearing me speak this way might say, oh, I'm very much against economics, but no, because I feel that actually without economics, without a lot of what economics has done, we wouldn't be where we are today. So economics does serve its function. It does serve a very valid function. But my question is really, is the function just to maximize goods? Is that enough for society? Or do we need more than that as humans? So this is really what this whole inquiry is about. What do we need as humans? We know that in the last 100 years, we have focused on maximizing goods. Very necessary, because we actually came from a period of want. And now we're in a very strange situation where we're in a period of plenty, but with scarcity. Okay? It's a real paradox. We live in an age of plenty in many respects, but there's real scarcity. And as Tim Jackson would have told you, it's scarcity not only in terms of financial resources, but also in terms of environmental resources, natural resources. So we are really very poor today, in some respect, as rich a society as we are. So I thought, well, let me go back really further. I went back, then I came forward, and I thought, well, let me go back again. Let me go back really to the first person in Western culture that discussed the concept of the economy, Aristotle. And Aristotle, I was very excited to reread Aristotle, because I thought, well, Aristotle actually talks to all three issues I'm interested in: money, love, and virtue. Because he wrote in The Politics about the economy being home management. It was a very simple society then. And some friends say, well, is Aristotle a good example to use? Because in those days there were slaves and women had no rights and, you know, only men were citizens. And I said, yes, it's true. But what I'm trying to look at is really the motivation behind the economy. Because even the slaves and the women were well taken care of, because there was the idea of virtue and eudaimonia, because Aristotle's objective was harmony in the polis, harmony in the state. And he felt that the only way to get to harmony in the state is first through philia, friendship, which he described as the ultimate love, because it permitted virtue. And he felt that virtue was pursued for its own sake, because virtue permitted eudaimonia, or flourishing, or happiness. And also very appropriate to today's reflection is that he saw that justice was the virtue that enabled all the virtues. So justice was really the most important virtue, because it was the virtue that enabled all other virtues. And he described justice as proportionality. And in today's world, where we have increasing wealth disparity, and where we have extreme rent extraction. I mean, 1970, the average salary of a CEO was 30 times that of an average worker. And by 2007, I think it was, the figure had gone to 263. So I don't know what the figure is now, but whether it's 300 or 250 or 320, you can see that huge disparity. It's a jump of, in terms of ratio, almost tenfold. So I thought, well, let's start looking at the economy as a way to organize society. But society is not just money. Society is also the person. And money is really the lifeblood of society. It's vital. We can't live without money, just as we can't live without blood. So money is the lifeblood which circulates within society and which brings either nutrients or toxins. And when I started thinking about that in the conversation with an economist who has been very helpful, you know, to me in my inquiry, he said, oh, Maria, you know, the Franciscan monks talked about money as lifeblood. I said, oh, really? Yes. And then another friend who is a psychiatrist said to me, oh, and, you know, Quesnay, who was an economist and also physician of Louis XV, talked about money as the lifeblood. I thought, well, there must be something to it, you know, because it is indeed the flow that goes to our society. So we see then that if we're talking about the person, I don't want to use the word individual, if we're talking about the person in society, then we're talking about the common good. And an economist that worked a lot with the idea of the common good was Antonio Genovesi, who was a contemporary of Adam Smith's, but he lived in Naples. And just as Quesnay was a physician as well as an economist, Genovesi was a priest as well as an economist. And because he was a priest, and he was in the age of the Enlightenment, his thought was very much influenced by Thomas Aquinas, who in turn was very much influenced by St. Augustine, who was in turn very much influenced by Aristotle. So then we see this thread of Western thought going back again, you know, to Aristotle. And Genovesi said that, you know, the most important aspect of a civil society within which the economy is, therefore the civil economy, is the common good. And in order to arrive at the common good, you have to have reciprocal relations. And the two foundations for civil society are justice, again, and humanity. Humanity in terms of dealing with each other. And he said that the essential preconditions for the common good are reciprocal confidence in each other, confidence in the system, trust in the system, mutual assistance, and fraternity or reciprocity. So then again, we are in the realm of human relations. So if we are in the realm of human relations, and if we are in the realm of common good, are we in the realm of virtue? Right. Now, I decided purposely to use the word virtue rather than ethics. Well, somebody said, well, why don't you use the word ethics? Because virtue is so old-fashioned, people don't use the word anymore. And I said, well, the reason I don't use the word ethics is because ethics is used so much for PR purposes. You know, we have ethical code, we have advertisements by different organizations saying, you know, we have an ethical committee. And because I'm using Aristotle such a lot in my argument and in my discussion, and he uses virtue, I felt this is a word that I want to use because this represents really the essence of what I'm trying to say. And in today's world, we think that markets do not need to be moral because the instrumentality of the market, the pricing mechanism in the market, leaves morality outside. All we need is a pricing system whereby people agree to buy and sell to each other. So we start off with self-interest of a person, we start off with the preference of a person, and then that leads to a social contract, or a business contract, which they not a social contract, and the contract needs to have no moral content. Because I can sell you something that is only worth one-tenth of what you were willing to pay. But if you're willing to pay, it's fine. Right? So the price mechanism will determine all exchange. And within this theory, there is no mutual assistance required. And in fact, mutual assistance would imply sacrifice, because then if I have to be concerned with someone else, I have to sacrifice perhaps part of my own good. However, there are two economists, Luigino Bruni, who is the one that I work a lot with. He's Italian, he teaches in Rome, and Robert Sugden, who is a professor at Norwich University. They've done a lot of work in the last 10, 20 years on virtual markets. They've written many papers, books. And they've done really interesting work because they say that, in fact, virtue is possible in markets. And not only is it possible, it's necessary. Because in markets, there has to be a fairness in exchange. There has to be justice. Because in any market transaction, in order for a market to survive, there has to be benefit for all parties. And if this skewed situation lasts for too long, you have market failure, which is actually what we had with the crisis. So reciprocity is necessary, virtue is necessary, and it doesn't imply sacrifice, because that's how really you ensure each other's long-term welfare. So it's self-interest in an expanded way and in a long, with a long vision rather than a short vision. And they say market, you know, allows, if a market is fair and just, it allows for dignity. It considers humanity. And Adam Smith, in his Wealth of Nations, says, well, liberty and markets are important, because with markets, and if you're able to earn your own keep by selling goods in the marketplace, you don't need to beg. You don't need to be a beggar. You can be self-sufficient. So in order for that economic scenario to take place, what is the most important consideration? It's the person. It's the person as an actor and the person as a member of society. So who is the person? Who is the person? We talk about the individual. We talk about the self. We don't talk too much about the person. In our economic world today and in the financial world, we focus on the material person, the ego. Very important. Primal needs, very important. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you can't go up to self-actualization until you have met the other basic needs. But we ignore the spiritual and the cultural person. In the marketplace, we do. We might not ignore that in society because we have wonderful museums, we have the lighthouse, which is such a wonderful building. But in the marketplace, we do. We ignore the spiritual and the cultural person. So the person is both material and spiritual and cultural. And the person in society is part of the whole of society. The person contributes and the person receives. Reciprocity. And the person in the society is interdependent. And I think in today's world, in the today's global world, with environmental challenges, all the more so. So we all impact on each other and on the whole. And the common good, we often talk about public goods. The common good is more than public goods. It's not just a collection of public goods and services, but it's also the sum of the civic conscience. So some of the civic conscience implies respect for another person's liberty. So Jean-Paul Ricoeur, which is who was a philosopher that I like a lot, he wrote a book called One Self as the Other, I think, in English. And, you know, he wrote a lot about what does liberty mean. You know? Because if I have liberty, you have liberty too. So if my liberty clashes with your liberty, one of us loses. So for that to be true liberty, both of your liberty and my liberty needs to be respected. So my liberty might end somewhere where yours begins, and yours might end somewhere where mine begins. So it's really this understanding of what the other's requirement is and what mine is. It's, again, reciprocity. So it requires a sense of what is right. So if we have an economy where that is working, you know, the way it would be nice if it did, then we have money, love, and virtue synchronized. So what does that mean? That would mean cooperation and collaboration. And we tend to think, again, in our economic system, we talk about competition. Collaboration is with family and friends, with a small community, but not necessarily in the marketplace. Competition. And Darwin's, again, is again another misinterpretation, because we always use Darwin's survival of the fittest to justify competition. But apparently he did not use the term survival of the fittest. It was adapted by someone else to suit a certain agenda at that given time. But it stayed with us, and even today, people always refer to it as if it's, you know, cast in stone. But nobody talks about later Darwin, where he wrote about cooperation and when he said that the human race could not have survived without cooperation. And in his book, what is it called, The Descent of Man, something, he writes, humans possess social instinct becoming more tender, more widely diffused, until they extend it to all sentient beings. When I read that, I thought, God, that sounds Buddhist. All sentient beings, that's what the Dalai Lama says all the time. And he also writes, as soon as this virtue is honored and practiced by some few of us, it spreads through instruction example to the young and eventually becomes incorporated in public opinion. That's the power of the heroic example. So Darwin came to believe that survival is much about cooperation, symbiosis, and reciprocity as it is about competition. So, what do we need for collaboration? We need compassion. What does compassion mean? Sharing in another's suffering. Now, in neuroscience, we hear more and more the theme of empathy, because there have been many studies, and actually a lot of it is due to the dialogue that was started between the Dalai Lama and Francisco Varela, who was a very famous neuroscientist, but who died now. He was Chilean. He died a few years back. Wonderful person. And so the dialogue that he started with the Dalai Lama really brought this cooperation between science, you know, and the spirit, if you will. And so a lot of studies were made into the mind, and you know, what is the ego, and whether the person is compassionate or not compassionate. So there have been a lot of studies done, you know, in that light, which shows that in fact the person may not be, by definition, may not be by nature altruistic, but the person is not by nature selfish either, which is what we tend to believe, that the person is by nature selfish. But the person is not by nature selfish. The person is by nature, has the capacity for altruism. But that has to be learned, as with a lot of other things. And there is a psychologist called Martin Hoffman, who's done a lot of work with children. He teaches at the University of New York. And he's done a lot of work with children, whereby he determined that, you know, children can be taught to be compassionate. But in order to be taught to be compassionate, they need to be taught the proper kind of discipline. But discipline through nurture and love. Okay, so not discipline, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, but positive and encouraging, nurturing discipline. And so empathy. Carl Rogers, who is a psychiatrist that works with this positive view of psychology rather than the pathological view of psychology, wrote empathy. He defined empathy as entering the private perceptual world of the other and become thoroughly at home at it, in it, moving in it delicately without making judgments. And Martin Hoffman, whom I talked about just now, writes, empathy is the glue that makes social life possible. So empathy is linked to love. Love is a word that actually, Pete said he was surprised to see the word love in finance. Most people are surprised to see the word love in finance. And but there's no reason that they should be. I will mention soon a French philosopher called Jean-Luc Marion. He criticized what he calls the banalization of love, weakened and compromised. We no longer have the words to speak of it, he writes, nor the concepts to think about it, nor the strength to celebrate it. So we have really deprived love of its force, nor the strength to celebrate it. It's a great celebration. We don't have the strength to celebrate it. Paul Tillich, who was a famous theologian of the 20th century, he wrote a book called Love, Power, and Justice. And he starts off with the same premise. He said, love is, these three words, not just love, love, power, and justice, are words that mean such different things to so many people that it's very difficult to have any dialogue using these words because people come from different perspectives. And so he said, in order to really understand these words, I have to go to the ontological roots of these words, you know, to the being, the state of being of these words. And he determined that, well, love is an emotion. It's a feeling. It starts as a feeling. But it's not simply an emotion. It's more than that. It's a moving power of life. It's a drive towards unity. Unity representing harmony and happiness. And he said something very interesting. He said, and there is a commandment of love. In the Christian faith, there's a commandment of love. And in other religions also. You know, the golden rule is a commandment of love in a way. Okay? The Buddhists believe a lot in compassion, which is a form of love. The Muslims do too. So in most religions, the Hindi, there is this underlying premise of love. So he said, if there is a commandment of love, it can't be an emotion. Because we can't command an emotion. We can't command a feeling. So love has an ethical nature. Now Tillich also, he felt that in our society, we have this polarized view of love and power. So love is seen as soft and weak, as a resignation of power. And power is strong and forceful, a denial of love. So I just learned a term. Love is a woo-woo word. Apparently the scientists use it to say that it's something that... What does it mean, Andrew?
Woo-woo means it says fluffy, you can't define it in a
thing. Okay, fluffy. And but Tillich is actually saying that love is not fluffy. Love is actually very powerful. And Martin Luther King, his student, at a speech once said this, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. Power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. We think of love actually as sentimental and anemic because we think of love without power. Then he goes on, power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. So, we have love as a power that enables justice, the greatest virtue. So the two of them link very nicely together. So, I mentioned Jean-Luc Marion just now. He's a philosopher, and he writes, well, the ego thinks, but the ego also loves. And he coined this term, you know, ego amans, the self that loves. And he said the self loves by feeling, but it's not an egotistical and possessive feeling. Because he said that, in fact, there's one single proof of love, and that is to give without return or chance of recovery, with the risk of losing. But love itself is never lost, because it is accomplished in loss. So the willingness to lose it actually gives you more in return. Luc Ferry, who's another French philosopher, he was at one time the Minister of Education in France, he wrote a book 3 years ago called, I was very surprised to see that, called Love, the New Spiritual Secularity. Okay? And in it, he argues, he said, we really need a new moral order. We need to have love. He said, in the future, love is going to shape our society for three reasons. One is that with the breakdown of the ethical, you know, with breakdown of Kant's ethical imperative, which was really, you know, there is an ethical imperative which guides me to act in a certain way. And in the course of the 20th century, particularly in the second half of the century, that broke down and the moral order broke down. And he said, and that void was filled by hyperconsumption and extreme egotism, which has brought us to the problems that we all know about now. So he says that we really need to recover a new moral order. But the new moral order cannot be Kant's imperative, an ethical imperative. It has to be something that is much more within us. And he criticized the Enlightenment for two reasons. He said, well, the Enlightenment focused on reason and it focused on liberty. But the Enlightenment forgot something very important. The Enlightenment forgot about wisdom. Right? And he said, and wisdom, the discovery of wisdom will lead us back to the discovery of love. So for him, it is not only because of the breakdown of the ethical order. He says that in today's world, where we have such complex challenges, such difficult problems, a global world where governments' ability to act is actually hampered because we're so interlinked, we see in the environmental situation. It's really very difficult for one government to act in isolation. So he said, in a world where government is weakened in the way it can respond to challenges, all the more we need civic action. We need people to help government to bring about results. So civil action manifested in fraternal love, permeating interactions, and providing substance to political action. Now, this is a very different view from Sir Dennis Robertson, who was an economist, who wrote a paper, I think it was 1956, called What Do Economists Economize On? Guess what? Anyone wants to guess? Love, exactly. Because he said love is a rare resource, and so therefore we can only share it with our family and our intimate circle, our friends, because if we share it too widely, we end up not having, you know, enough of the ones that we truly love. But then that is looking at love as a material resource. And it's not a material resource, as we've seen. So love is not a limited resource, but in fact, it's the only infinite resource we have in a world of scarcity, financial and environmental scarcity. It is the only infinite resource, the only resource we have that is infinite. But we have to produce it ourselves. So it requires action. It's not just an infinite resource that we can take without participating in its creation. So this is what I find very exciting, because it's a resource, the generation of which we participate in together. So going back to John Stuart Mill, I said that he was a very contradictory, a paradoxical character, because when he wrote The Principles of Political Economy, he said it was, you know, we can't think about motivation. The man, you know, the human being is rational. And at that time, there were a lot of criticism about it. You know, the John Ruskin and a lot of the, you know, people from the Romantic period, the poets, they really did not like John Stuart Mill's political economy, nor did they like the concept of utilitarianism. So his response to the criticism was, well, you know, this is all sentimentality, and it's all unjust, sorry, and it's not substantial. And he said, you know, I appeal to man's reason. You know, I can only appeal to man's reason. And but then he got married to a woman with whom he had a very, very close relationship, Harriet Taylor. They had a long friendship, but Harriet Taylor was married, and she became a widow. And when she became a widow, their friendship, you know, developed further, and they got married. And through his marriage to Harriet Taylor, he learned that true happiness came not from aiming to maximize one's own happiness, but by fixing on some object other than oneself. And he described ultimate happiness as coming from experiencing another's happiness. And he, like Aristotle, equated love with friendship. So, and the interesting thing is also, you know, on the subjugation of women. I mean, a lot of people say that actually John Stuart Mill was the first person to write on behalf of women's rights, because he wrote this essay on the subjugation of women, together with Harriet Taylor, you know, his wife. And so at the end of his life, he really tried to make up for the harm that he saw subsequently that he had done. And the other interesting thing is another economist, Wilfredo Pareto, who was one of the two that had, you know, come up with the theory of instrumentality, at some stage towards the end of his life, he gave up economics because he was trying to understand why his principles, his economic principles or theory, which was so well thought of, did not seem to work in real life. So he spent the rest of his life studying sociology to try to find an answer for it, and he never did, sadly enough. So, neuroscience. I mentioned neuroscience earlier, and I bring in Antonio Damasio. He is a neuroscientist who has written a lot of books, very interested in ethics, really believes in the possibility of cultivation, of cultivating moral behavior, but he again says that it's important to start. So for those of you involved in education, it's very important to start from young, from a young age. And in his last book, Self Comes to Mind, he described the brain as being connected to the body through feeling. And he said we have three selves, the primordial self, the core self, and the autobiographical self. Okay? Now, again, in our economy, we focus on the first two, not so much on the social and the spiritual self. But he said that is the most important self because that is the self through which the reflective conscious mind works. And the mind, tempered by feeling and guided by memory, seeks the well-being not only of the individual but of the compounded society. And it's through that seeking of the well-being of society that we have moral rules and laws and justice system. Justice. Michael Sandel. I like him a lot. I'm bringing up some of the names because I think that this would be interesting for you to also look and read into, because Michael Sandel is a contemporary philosopher. I think he teaches at Yale, I believe. He wrote a book on justice, whereby he says there are three ways to look at justice. You know, there's the John Rawls way, which is really looking at the perfect institution and the perfect law, okay, in order to be able to ensure freedom. Okay. There's Amartya Sen's way, which is more similar to the common good, if you will, where he says what's important is not, yes, the institution is important, but equally important is the capability, the human capacity to attain justice. So in other words, are the conditions in place to allow people to attain justice? Okay. And he said that a justice system cannot be self-seeking. You know, it has to provide for reciprocity and mutual benefit. And within that system, the institution is important, but equally important is civic action. And then we have the Aristotelian perspective, which is the individual perspective. How can I, as an individual, work towards cultivating justice for myself and for the system, the virtue and the good life? So here we have really three, I would say there are actually three pillars that are required. So we need to have an institution as perfect as possible. You know, we need to have the civic action in society, and then we need to have the person or the individual working within that system. So, the central banking view of the financial system is that it has to have the proper regulation and supervision. It has to have the proper, at the micro level, it has to have the proper capital requirements, the proper solvency of banks, and it has to provide the right information to the clients. So products have to be transparent. They were not transparent before the crisis. So now there are rules that are coming out that specify all of that. So the consumer, the client, is protected more. But is that enough, or do we need more than that? Robert Shiller, who's one of the Nobel, you know, laureates for economics this year, he wrote a book called Finance and Good Society. And he said that finance is a science of goal architecture. So what we do is we establish a set of goals that we try to achieve. And it has to ensure the stewardship of those assets. And we need to, one of the problems today, leading to the problem today, and it continues to be the problem today, is we focus too much on the short term, on portfolio optimization, on trading, okay, what some people call casino finance. And what we really need to do is focus on the long term, because finance can be beneficially employed in constructive deal making, you know, in the structuring of projects, enterprises, and systems. So he used fairness to justify finance as the goal end of society, and that's why I don't agree with him, because I don't think finance is the end of society. I think the finance is the means, or the lifeblood, to an end, and the end is the common good. And finance really derives from fides or trust, not so much from fairness. So, coming back, you know, thinking back on the Enlightenment principles and say, well, if we bring it back to bring it forward to today's world, what do we need? And Martha Nussbaum was asked that question at the Royal Society of Art, again a philosopher, one that I like to read a lot, very concerned about ethics, always goes back to Aristotle and to the Greeks. She said that we really need to have critical thinking. And that's why, you know, I titled my talk Reflecting On, because reflection is very important in this whole resolution that we're trying to find. So we need to ask the question, what do we stand for? You know, the Aristotelian self-examination. And civic action again. You know, we need to have a sense of global citizenship. So civic action on a global level, not purely on a municipal level, and empathy. We need to be able to feel, to understand the other's, you know, the other's position. So three words that she used, which I think, you know, might be more appropriate for contemporary world, is instead of liberty, is autonomy. We have to understand, you know, what does autonomy mean? You know, what does it mean? Talked earlier about the mirror image of liberty. You know, there's no full autonomy for anybody. There's always some restraint that's required. And universalism instead of equality, because we are in, you know, a universal world with a lot of different races, a lot of different countries. And she said it's important also to understand that sometimes we might be hypocritical in relation to empathy. We might be empathic to some but not to others, and we might be willing to compromise our principles in some cases. And she said empathy without principles does not work. So there needs to be a rigor in that. And then fraternity, humanism, although she says she prefers the word human dignity. Right? But we're talking, whether it's humanism or human dignity, we're really talking about the same thing. It's about respect for the other. And again, she says it's important to start learning as children. So, goods. Pete mentioned, you know, our hyper-consumption. And Robert Skidelsky, another economist, and his son Edward Skidelsky, who's a philosopher, wrote a book, How Much Is Enough? Love of Money and the Good Life. Came out last year, I think, or this year earlier. And in that, they argue that, well, we need to start thinking about things other than material goods. You know, we need to start thinking about basic goods, which are universal and indispensable, because material goods, at some level, they're dispensable. And he said the basic goods are health, security, respect, friendship, leisure, harmony with nature, and autonomy. Now, leisure in his mind is not, or in their mind, is not just entertainment. Leisure is to use creatively one's time. And he is actually a specialist. He's probably the economist who knows the most about John Maynard Keynes. And he referred to Keynes' lecture, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, whereby Keynes painted some future where all our material needs are, you know, met. And so therefore we can really start pursuing leisure or the creative mind rather than... So Keynes, again, you know, an economist that a lot of people admire, as do I. And I love this quote from Keynes, one of my favorite. He said, an economist must be mathematician, historian, statesman, and philosopher. Now, I think most economists today are mathematicians. So, what do we need in a good society? We need empathy and collaboration, trust and justice, long-term and integral version, liberty, autonomy, virtue, common good, and reciprocity, which is really an economic resource, reciprocity. So this chart represents where we are now. So money dictates. Money dictates love, money dictates virtue. Money buys friendship, money buys a lot of things. Money can also serve as, how would I say, can also serve to ensure a certain level of virtue, because through penalties, in the case of trespass, that's money taken away, that's one way of motivation. But what I'm trying to suggest that we start thinking about is really a different concept of how these three interact. So, if we have love feeding virtue, and virtue in turn feeding love, and then both love and virtue influencing how money is used, we then have a situation that better serves the human being. And Pitirim Sorokin, who is a sociologist who is not, you know, well known, I suppose because his findings did not suit the agenda, but he actually founded the Department of Sociology at Harvard University. And he headed a research center called the Center for Altruistic Research. And they did a lot of work on the ways and power of love, which is a result of a, you know, research that they had done. And in that book, the thing that really jumped out at me was this: a heroic example calling forth mimesis and catharsis is more important than the publication of thousands of books. So when I read that, I thought, should I even bother trying to write a book? But then on the other hand, I felt that really, what is necessary is language. In order to get culture working a certain way, language is very important. So I really see my role in all of this as contributing to a change in the language. And I understand that there are examples, heroic examples here in Glasgow, Andrew told me, where money, love, and virtue may be working together. So if any of you here is involved in those initiatives, I'd love to, you know, hear your comments, and I'm also here to answer any questions, or I'd love to hear the feedback that you may have. And that's it.